A busy show to kick off a new week on Connecticut Today for Monday, August 24th. We welcome back to the program in the 3 o'clock hour political pundit Dan Neumeyer. We analyzed a festering problem with the state Republican Party coming off a controversial candidate in the 2nd Congressional District GOP primary. We heard portions of Governor Ned Lamont's latest coronavirus update, where he covered a number of topics. That was in the 4 o'clock hour. We wrapped up the show with Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield monitoring the situation post-Tropical Storm Isaias regarding Eversource and the United Illuminating Company. State Republican Party here in Connecticut after the primary on August 11th, which Justin Anderson eventually won after a recount of about a half percent over Thomas Gilmer. Thomas Gilmer, you may remember the first time we talked about this, had some pretty serious criminal charges facing him now, some assault and abuse charges. However, there was a controversy as to what the top leadership, including J.R. Romano, knew about this in the state Republican Party, some controversy as to what they knew, when did they know it, why were things not said earlier. This has been a developing story over the past couple of weeks, and joining us right now to talk about it, Dan Neumeyer, a political pundit here in the state. He's worked for both parties, the D's and the R's, and knows from which all this stuff tends to happen. Dan, how are you again? Good to talk to you.
Oh, great to be with you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Dan, yeah, so what's the scenario right here? Now, the last time we talked, the race was kind of still in doubt. There was a recount here. So, you know, to save a tad of embarrassment here, Justin Anderson did win. Where do we stand here? I'm going to ask you to speak up, too, because your phone line's a little weak. Go ahead.
All right. Can you hear me all right?
You're a little bit better. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
All right. Well, a couple things, Paul. So you're right. What happened is that when they had the primary vote, Tom Gilmer was ahead by, I guess, 30 or so votes. And so it automatically triggered a recount of the vote. So we were kind of in limbo for 4 days. And, you know, whatever happened in that time, maybe God touched a dear soul who tossed one of Gilmer's boxes into the river or something like that. I don't know what happened, but in that particular case, so be it. I'm happy that it did. And Justin Anderson moved forward in that contest. But what it did is it opened up a rift in the party as to what kind of party are we, and how is the handling of how candidates are vetted, or in this case, were not vetted. There was no vetting of these candidates. Otherwise, serious allegations against Tom Gilmer would have come to light instantly. There was stuff that was right on the surface. And interestingly enough, about a year ago, a young man who was part of an RTC, he was out and he heard Mr. Gilmer's stump speech, and he said, wow, this is amazing. This guy's done so much by the age of 29, multi-million dollar deals and everything, and all these assertions on his website. Well, we started to dig into it, and none of it was true, right? It was all baloney. So he brought this forward to people, and he was shut down. And so there's some very, very big names who, you know, knew there were issues early on and at any time could have, you know, gone on the internet to verify some of them, but that didn't happen. So now we're kind of in a situation where, okay, what, you know, J.R. Romano runs the state party, but what does the state party actually do? Do they, you know, did they sit a candidate down and talk to them? Apparently not. They don't do that at the RTC level and down in Madison, apparently, because that's where Gilmer was from. And Amy Stefanowski is the RTC chair there. And there's a lot of indications and rumor now that, you know, somebody brought this forward last year, made a protest about this. There was all kinds of documentation, which I've actually had a chance to kind of look at. And it looks pretty damning to me, but that's for others to decide. it brings up the bigger question, Paul. So we have the state party turns away this domestic abuse victim, says go get counseling, talk to the police, doesn't want to know about it, nothing. Most people, excuse me, would have said, hold on, you're telling me you're willing to drop out of the race if somebody will please, please, please just take a look at this guy because there's something really wrong here, which was said to J.R. Romano. And when they talked to Gilmer about it, he said, you know what? If anybody says any of that, I'm going to launch a lawsuit. I'm putting cease and desist letters on everybody. There's nothing to see here. This is all BS and everything. The other guy's saying, I've looked at all the evidence. There's 18 pages of it here that have nothing to do with domestic abuse. There's a problem here. Look at this guy. Wasn't done. Then we learn that at the primary, at the nomination at the convention, that people actually knew. People in the GOP knew there were allegations against Gilmer, and yet they pushed his nomination through anyway. And the thing that really, really sticks out to me here, Paul, is that the young woman who brought this forward, who was dealing with police at the time, she was already involved with the police. There was an incident prior to this on Gilmer that they could have looked up in just by looking up an arrest record or looking into him with one of those $20 background checks that would have popped up. But they didn't do that. So now here's the survivor watching the coronation of the abuser right in front of their eyes. And people still knew that Justin Anderson was going around and doing this thing. So when I entered the thing, this is where I kind of came in, was about 4 days before that vote. And I'm thinking, wow, here's this guy. He's telling me the whole story. I asked him how the campaign was going. Oh, yeah, I'm trying to help this person. This came forward with all this stuff. And so I started to dig into it. I'm like, God, I got to help these people bring this all this stuff forward. You know what I mean? Well, now that it's 2020, Paul, and I'm looking back at the whole thing, it looks to me like this guy, Anderson, kind of sat on this stuff, much to other people's criticism of him, and then used it to take out his opponent. And that is just so disgusting. And what really makes me angry about this is that former Congressman Rob Simmons would tell you, and he said on the radio, both these candidates are Kleenex candidates, right? They have no chance of winning. They have no chance of being there. They're not going to win. They can't raise money. They don't understand the process. They don't understand how anything works. They're Kleenex candidates. It happens all the time, especially in that race, because we have no party that supports candidates.
Yeah.
So neither of these guys was going to win. And all of a sudden, we end up with this tremendous black eye for 10,000 Republicans who voted for Gilmer when the party knew. Now, I don't know about you, but a lot of the people, I have a poll up at the ctstrategistreport.com where you can say, get rid of, vote, have JR resign or have him stay. But it's literally 10-11 to 1 for resign because they knew about it. They could have told people there's a problem here. You know, we can't move forward till we look into this. And it didn't have to be some big, legalese, but if you were a reasonable person sitting there, Paul, and you've had somebody come in saying, look, I'll drop out of the race. I've looked at all this stuff. This is a bad dude, and we have to check this out. And then another guy telling the opposite, everybody's lying, and I'm going to sue everybody and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Doesn't that warrant a little deeper dive, right?
One would think, Dan, hang on a minute, Dan. I got to take a break here, and we'll come back and talk about more of the whys, W-H-Y-S, the whys behind this. Dan Neumeyer is the guest. We'll take a break, come back with Dan, talk about more about the mess in the 2nd Congressional District and how that's really a stain on a party that all my callers say, well, why aren't the Republicans stronger in Connecticut? Well, maybe this is an indication. Dan, hang on. Traffic and weather together, 316 on WICC. All right, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Dan Neumeier's with us, political strategist, worked both sides of the aisle here in Connecticut, so he can tell you what the story is from both sides of the aisle. Dan, back to this mess in the 2nd District and the race between Justin Anderson and Thomas Gilmer. And what Rob Simmons had said, and I can kind of understand that. And I think there have been one or two media outlets. I know the Day of New London newspaper has called for J.R. Romano to resign. You know, Dan, I get calls on this show, and you've got them here, too, in the other stations you've worked at. About one-third of the voters in this state, Republicans and maybe a little more, maybe right-leaning centrists, are constantly frustrated, and I hear the same thing from them. It's like, why don't we have a Republican Party in this state that's well-funded, that's got a little bit of a little kick to it, you know, when it comes to winning a race or two, getting legislative priorities passed, and they're very frustrated. Why is that? Why doesn't that happen, Dan?
Well, I would say, first of all, that when this scandal broke, right out of the gate, you had Senator Clardis put her foot down and lay down the law on this, that it's unacceptable to do nothing, right? And to let this travesty go on. And that both candidates in this thing are not qualified or suitable to run. But you also had former congressman of the district, Rob Simmons, come in. He said it's an abomination, right? Look it. You have to have people who can come to consensus with other people at the legislature on legislation. So I am a centrist myself. I'm exactly in the group of those people that you're talking about, Paul. And so is Congressman Simmons. So is House Leader Themis Clardis. So is Representative Holly Cheesman, who has not stopped ringing the bell for the victim. Yeah. Vincent Candeloro, Representative Candeloro. Yeah. Noreen Caruta, Senator Summers, Senator Whitcoast, an ex-police officer. Citizen, you can't. You're the leader. You got to get up there. Jamie Stevenson probably wrote the most powerful letter there was, right? Mm-hmm. She said this is unacceptable. We have to rebuild the party into a party that can win elections. And that means that we don't do stupid things like this when we don't have to, when it could have been avoided so easily. But it's the message that comes out of the party, and you can talk to Congressman Simmons if you want to have him on about this. He'd be great to talk about this. But the message that's coming out of there is that rhinos, right, all the people in the middle, right, of the bell curve, all of us who care about some social issues, but we're fiscal conservatives, right? We want the state to run in like a well-oiled top.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But what's happened is we have a party, a state party of sycophants, who are more into this cult of personality with J.R. Romano, and they call, take calls, and they don't know that there's anything better. They get their rubber chicken dinner, right? They get their little pin that says CTGOP, and this is some kind of badge of honor to show up and have a martini. They're not out there helping anybody. Ask any state party. Get in there and say, you know, how much has the state party really done to help you do anything? Ask the 2nd District candidate last time that quit the race because he couldn't even get a call back.
Dan, is it a question of money? Is it because the party is underfunded?
No, it really isn't. It really isn't. And, well, money is a function of how well you're doing, right? People don't want to give money to the losing team. So the problem becomes that comparatively, and I can speak on this in depth, compared to what I did for the unions and the Democrats, and I look at the CTGOP machine, which I've been trying to get my brain around since 2011, and I finally figured out that the easiest thing to do was to go around it and make the Connecticut Taxpayers Union. So I'm just, you know what I mean? Because the entrenched people in that organization are more concerned about sticking together and having that unity than they are about winning any elections or helping us win elections, in my opinion. And I've seen this, Paul. We used to vet candidates, right? Any candidate, whether it was at a town level, whether it was at a state house level, or whether it was a federal candidate. We would have big meetings in the union with the Senate Democrats, with party people, to sit down and talk to these people. And many of them had things in their background, maybe not as severe as this one, but they had stuff. And we had to decide, is that a, you know, is that something that's passable, or is this a no-go?
Yeah. Yeah, right? Like I told you before, Dan, I was
facing the ground is a no-go.
Yeah, and like I said, in the times where, you know, years and years ago, I haven't done it since, and I thoroughly enjoy doing it. But in the times that I was asked to years ago consult on some campaigns and help out some people, you know, with some media advice, one of the big questions they gave me was, they looked me in the eye and they said, is there anything, and we mean anything, in your background, you know, starting with a late library book that, you know, is going to, and I thought, and I said, well, this, if you consider that bad, but and so I know what that question is. Dan, I've got to run, my friend. Thank you so much. Yeah, Dan, I got to run. What? Give us your websites again for people who can check you out and see what Dan Neumeier has to say.
The best way to connect with me is ctstrategistreport.com, and then you can go on my Facebook page of the same name through there, the ctstrategistreport.com. And then there's a lot of stuff posted about this whole thing from beginning to end. And it's really worth taking a look at to see, you know, how convoluted and who's involved and how Gilmer won these. I mean, you and I could do a complete 4-hour show on this, on all the ins and outs, because there's some really fascinating stuff. But thank you very much, Paul. And I am very honored to always come on with you. You're a legend here in the business, and it's a big honor.
Thank you, Dan. Those are kind words. Appreciate it. Daniel Kent Neumeier. Check him out at on Facebook and the CT Strategist Report, ctstrategistreport.com.
We're solely getting our kids back to school. That involves child care, and they have a point of view, which we ought to talk about a little bit today. But first, I wanted to talk about utility accountability and reform. We got hit hard by a tropical storm a few weeks ago. And you don't want to lose these moments. You want to make these learning moments. You want to get better. After George Floyd, we had accountability and reform. After this tropical storm, we have utility accountability and reform. And the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, PURA, is meeting right now. They've been meeting all day. There are well over 1,000 people voicing their discontent in terms of how slow the utilities were in responding to what was a really severe storm, and in many cases, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days to get their power back on. And how do we learn from this, and how do we do things differently? We had a learning lesson about 10 years ago with Sandy. We thought we put in some reforms then. They didn't really make a big difference in terms of performance this time around. And as the chart says, insanity, keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. And what's really important is, you know, lawsuits and refunds and firing CEOs. It's important is that we tie the incentives together in a way that Eversource and the consumers of the state of Connecticut are aligned in terms of making sure the key priorities are taken care of. And that's what a performance-based rate of return means. And that's what I am pushing on, and that's what I testified on today at the PURA hearing. And a performance-based means you get a good rate of return. In this case, it's about 9.5%. Not showing up, not because you are an electric utility, but because you've earned performance metrics in a number of different categories. Here are a few of them that Marissa Gillette, who's our great chairperson of PURA, came out of Maryland, where they did put in place some very interesting performance reforms already. So we're learning from that example. You know, number one is affordability. Let's face it, we have some of the highest rates in the country. Right now, for a utility, it's a pass-through. The electric generators, be they wind, be they natural gas, be it nuclear, they just pass along those expenses on to you. I'm not big on just simply passing along. I like people to have incentives to hold down costs. You know, related to costs, of course, is, you know, compliance with the environmental goals. So I'd like to hear the Environment Committee at the legislature as we weigh in, as we think about energy sources and their carbon footprint, as we try and get the right balance going forward. Probably most importantly, given the example that we all had, given the outages a couple of weeks ago, is reliability and resilience. And there, again, there's a cost-benefit analysis to that. But what we ought to do is reward electric utilities, in this case, Eversource and UI, in terms of, A, how they reduce the number of outages during good time, that's called reliability, and how quickly they can restore power during bad times after a storm. And that's a metric that I think we ought to be serious about right now. And we measure based upon outcomes. You know, it's not our job to say this should go underground or this should be aerial. Unfortunately, Connecticut, we have a lot of ledge. So I know from firsthand that underground is very expensive, except in the most important circumstances. And underground is not as good next to shorelines where you may have increasing flooding over a period of time. For better or for worse, I love the trees, but the trees also wreak havoc in terms of electric reliability. And we got to measure that. And probably from my point of view, most importantly, is smart meters and remote status monitoring. You know, we were forced to do that in the cable TV industry. We did that 20 years ago. And I was really surprised that every single town I went to visit during the outages, we were waiting and waiting and waiting for that lineman from Eversource to show up. So you could see in a picture like this, when that wire was down, the tree took it down, we needed a line person to measure the voltage and make sure that wire was off and it was safe to start making repairs. I mean, there, I think there's incredible room for performance, whether it be pre-positioning more line people or more remote status monitoring so you can actually turn that hot wire off and get the repairs done sooner. Make safe. It was incredible how long it took to make safe, to get those roads safe, to get those roads cleared as a precondition to getting electricity on. And getting electricity on was a precondition to getting your internet and other telecom services on. So that is what we're tasking PURA, we're urging PURA, take another look at how we regulate the utilities. I'm happy to reward for good performance, and I'm happy to penalize for bad performance. I think that's how you get good performance. And I do not want to have happen next time what happened last time. That said, we can answer questions on that. COVID daily summary. Daily summary is now for the last few days, which I think is appropriate. Of interest here, I think you'll see we've done a lot of testing, 55,000 tests. I think that's about 125,000 on a weekly basis. The positive cases is 492, looks like a big number, but as a percentage of all the tests, that's still below 1%. And you know, we feel confident on that number, feel good about that number. Fatality zero for 3 days. That is just prayerfully good news. And hospitalizations about the same, plus three. But look, we're not out of the woods, so to speak. And we've been watching like a hawk, as I keep saying, all around the state, what is going on. And one place that we're a little worried about is Danbury, where there seems to be a cluster, where there seems to be a fair number of infections going on there. They've surged up a little bit. There's a 7% positivity rate. If the rest of the state is less than 1%, Danbury is about 7%. So it does worry us that that number has gone up quite a bit. A lot of that is perhaps related to populations that come in from out of the country, maybe visiting folks at home. So we have to be able to address each and every one of these special populations, tell them the importance of quarantining and the importance of testing. And with that, you have to find somebody who can speak the native language in order to talk to these people. And who do you think we go to for that, Max?
Governor Ned Lamont in his coronavirus update talking about the need to reach foreign-speaking populations as far as a spike in cases in Denver.
All right, that's good. The point is, Dr. Koh, who's a leading epidemiologist in the state of Connecticut, who was co-chairman of our Reopen Connecticut campaign, is also talking Portuguese to the affected population. He throws a tight spiral football, and he'll be also talking in Svengali to another population very soon. This guy does everything. But seriously, what this says is how we have to reach out to each and every population, talk to them in their own language, and in this case, as Dr. Koh is doing, is reminding them quarantining and testing, that's the law, those are the rules going forward. If you keep moving that forward, we've had a farm worker housing in East Windsor. Again, we watch that. These are folks, they live in very, very tight quarters. They're working on farms here as well as, I think it's Massachusetts, 30 out of the 90 people there infected. This is why we're doing so much testing, so that we can detect people early on in the cycle, get them track and traced, and narrow the scope, narrow the spread of this virus in any way we can. And today we've been relatively successful there, I think. The nursing home in Norwich, again, 15 infections, a big problem. We're looking hard to see how that happened. Sanctions will be implemented. But I just want you to know that that's one nursing home. All the other nursing homes around the state of Connecticut combined, 4 infections. So we're trying to get a handle and look at these flare-ups before they become fires, and that's really important. Again, we're just reminding people, follow the rules, self-quarantine, wear the face coverings, social distance, and get tested. We have testing, we're more prevalent, we're more likely to do it than any place else, and we're doing this because this is, allows us to contain the nature of the spread. You know, with that, I really want to introduce Beth Bai. She runs our early childhood, and this is really important. Beth and I were on with hundreds of child care workers and providers today, and there was some anxiety there. I'll tell you, they say, look, I see the teachers are anxious, and maybe they're going to be hybrid, not a full-time basis. Some of them are 2 days. Some people are home 3 days. Some people at home 3 days. They can't be at home, so they're going to be at daycare. We have to ramp up. Everybody's going to have a different 2-day, 3-day cycle. And the potential is that that expands the exposure, expands the nature of the cohorts. We take this seriously as well. I know how seriously you take the health care of your teachers, which we do. And we were there to give them confidence that we're there to back them up as regards what they need in terms of mask, what they need in terms of disinfectant, what we can do to make sure that they are continuing to provide service safely for those most in need in our child care facilities. And Beth, I just want you to know, I was so proud talking to these workers. I mean, it was during the very height of the pandemic, Beth. We desperately needed them. We needed them there as you helped set up a freelance childcare right next to our hospital so nurses had safe childcare so they could take care of those who are sick. No questions asked. These are the providers that went right in and took care of people. And I want you to know that we need you again. We need you going forward. We're doing everything we can to keep you safe. Beth, any comments?
Yeah, thank you so much, Governor. It was wonderful to have you on this morning with the early childhood providers. Let me start by saying, as a resident, seeing 0 deaths over 3 days, I know so many people around the state watch those numbers. It's really testament to the residents of Connecticut and to your approach that I think that I know we're not out of the woods, but that's wonderful. Yeah. You know, I don't know if people know, but 70% of households with children 0 to 11 need childcare in order to work. And so these are really challenging times for parents and for programs. Those childcare workers, like you said, Governor, have been on the front lines. Between 1,500 and 1,900 programs have been open since March. And they've been doing a super job following public health guidance. Hand washing, cohorting, making sure that they talk with parents about not sending children when they're sick. And out of those 1,500 to 1,900 programs, the Office of Early Childhood has had just 50 cases reported in childcare. So the hard work of those providers following public health guidance has helped parents be able to get to work, has provided children with really needed structure, routine, and education, and has also kept children and workers safe. But as you said, they're anxious. They still need the PPE. They need enhanced guidance. And it's a really stressed field right now financially. And so the state has invested more than $100 million in state and federal funds so far over COVID. And we're working closely with our federal delegation to try to get another $100 to $300 million so that these programs can sustain through COVID. And Governor, we really appreciate you and the Lieutenant Governor's connection with our congressional delegation and Dan Desimone to get these critical dollars. So we have had good outcomes. We're really proud of the providers. As you said, the hybrid models are challenging for them because camps and childcare have done a super job, but they've been in one cohort. So now as families use them for childcare out of the schools, it's, you know, children back and forth between different cohorts. So they're really gonna have to be extra cautious about the health guidance and about looking for any signs of illness before children walk in each day. Governor, today you committed to testing for childcare workers, and they were so relieved to hear that. They have been getting tested as needed, but you've agreed to make it easier for them without the costs. And over the past month, we've been rolling out business grants and supply grants to try to help. And we know these are important, but they're not sufficient. So we're going to continue, like you said, to stand with childcare providers who've been there for our state at the most difficult time, despite their own anxieties for children and families. So happy to answer questions as needed, Governor.
No, thank you, Beth. Right. And as Beth points out, for that second grade class, if they can stay with themselves over 5 days, that's much safer for them and their teacher, rather than have them 2 days with their second grade class and then the rest of the time with a different group out there, like, for example, at a childcare facility. That's really worth remembering as we slowly ease into our school day. And also, as Beth pointed out, look, we have 1,400 providers. We had thousands and thousands of kids, as well as teachers, you know, there for the childcare, you know, going back to March, I think it is, and 50 infections. So as Beth is pointing out, it was probably safer at daycare than it was in the general population, just like it was safer as a nurse than it was in the general population, if you take the necessary precautions. And we're doing everything we can to take those necessary precautions. Max?
Fox 61.
Thank you. Governor, my first question, with all eyes on Danbury at the moment, do we have a plan for the surrounding towns of Danbury when it comes to the COVID-19 infections as far as reopening and as well for education for those parents who are a little bit worried about their kids going back to school being so close to Danbury?
Yeah, well, first of all, Josh and Deirdre have really had a the COVID cavalry has come into Danbury. We ramped up our testing dramatically there throughout the community going forward. Mayor Mark Boughton has canceled the youth sports, at least through the summer and probably longer than that, just to be Connecticut State University. The residence halls were gonna be filled, now they're not. We're gonna take a pause on that. So we're doing everything we can. The nursing homes, we're testing everybody again in those nursing homes. So we are bringing in the bucket brigade there to make sure that any flare up there we take care of immediately. And more broadly to your other question is, what does that mean to the greater region? As you look at you know, New Fairfield and the other towns in the area, we're watching that very closely. So far, their infection rates have stayed very low. And that's why their schools are continuing to be able to open on a regular basis as they see fit.
Thank you. And one more question, if you don't mind. When it comes to what we're seeing nationwide as far as Wisconsin goes, in Kenosha, where we saw a African-American male being shot in the back 7 times by police, we were wondering if you saw the video and had any comments on that.
I was shocked. My God, just so soon after George Floyd, and you thought that was a wake-up call. And my God, that will never happen again. And there it is. Right there, you know, in the video, I did take a look at that, and I see the frustration, I see the violence, and I hope other states reacted like Connecticut did. We showed that we take this seriously. We love and respect our police, but we also hold people accountable. That's why we did the police accountability bill. And we don't necessarily stop there. You know, I was shocked to see that and shocked that this continues again and again and again.
Thank you, Governor.
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. Just following up to the president's announcement yesterday about the emergency use of plasma therapy. Have you talked to any of the hospitals here in Connecticut today? Do you have any expectation that that therapy, that treatment would be expanded now here in the state for potential patients?
I think I'll probably defer to Josh on that. I just think you have to be careful about all these new therapies. We've been doing some plasma therapy at some of our hospitals right now for those particular need, but it's not a miracle cure. And it's really important that the FDA maintain its credibility, because we are going to have therapies, and someday we are going to have a vaccine. And people have to have confidence that we didn't rush this, we didn't cut corners, we did it in the appropriate way so that the therapy of the vaccine could be safe. If people have doubts about that, we're not going to be able to implement them. Josh, anything else?
Yeah, I think that's well said.
And just also in terms of the schools, I know we've talked a lot about if there is a positive case, whether a teacher or a student, that the cohorts would be quarantined. But what about the rest of the school? Would all the parents of the school be notified that there is a potential case?
I would think they should be, but let me check with the powers that be on that. Most importantly, we don't have to shut down the middle school. We don't have to shut down the school if we kept the cohort tight, meaning just those kids within that third grade class. Those 24 kids would have to quarantine plus the teacher for a period of time. That's why cohorting of these pods is such an important part of our reopen strategy.
Governor, if I can just speak to what's happened in childcare when there are cases, it's a really great question. And I think for schools, as with childcare, the parent communication is key, having parent trust. And so when there have been cases, even if they're kept to a cohort, the childcare programs have notified everyone in the program. So every parent knows what's happening. But local health guides the decisions about whether to close one class or two classes, depending on staffing and how tight the cohorts are. But keeping the cohorts tight, as the governor said, is critical. So that's just what's happened in childcare.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, keeping on the theme of schools, the White House is labeling teachers as essential workers, which means that, you know, teachers exposed to the virus but who also show no symptoms could return to the classroom and not have to quarantine for 14 days. How are we planning on handling that here in Connecticut?
I hadn't focused on that, but I think if you've been exposed to the virus, you should quarantine for 14 days. Now let me ask Albert Coe.
Yeah, no, that is certainly the guide. The strong guidance from our public health department is exactly as the governor said. People who have been exposed to the virus absolutely need to stay home, self-isolate for 14 days. That is how we stop the spread. And so that's an important individual responsibility for anyone who's been contacted or exposed. But it's also a community responsibility when we're working with our partners in Danbury and other communities. Help out your neighbors and your friends who may have been exposed, right? They may need food delivered to them. They may need help getting a kid somewhere. And so this is a team sport that we have to work together, whether it's in a school district or in a community like Danbury that needs a little extra help right now.
Got it. Then also on schools, you know, last month the guidance came out encouraging schools to have UV light and extra ventilation for classrooms. We wanted to know, to what extent were local police departments consulted when crafting these plans? Because we've heard from a couple of local chiefs concerned about school safety. They're worried that too many openings or too much ventilation could pose a safety issue in and of itself.
Boy, you got me there. I think that's been probably left up to local superintendents and principals to deal with the local police in terms of that. But you're right, we've made a special effort in terms of ventilation. We found that 4 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet separated is a lot less important given the nature of the aerosolizing of the germ. than ventilation. Sometimes you can do it by opening windows. Sometimes you can do it with a filter on some of the air holding systems. That is a priority for us.
Back here on WICC 600, back to Hartford. More comments from the governor. This is Paul Mounds, the governor's chief of staff, addressing what the stage looks like for high school sports in the coming year.
For the reason that is a sport that involves close, sustained contact, the lack of protective barriers, high probability for respiratory exchange. DPH had to make those recommendations based upon not only what the National Federation of State High School Sports had put forth, but also based upon what the guidelines that CIAC was looking to put forth as well. So at the end of the day, DPH provided a letter yesterday, which reiterated the previous guidance that they provided before, and CIAC will be in the position to make a final decision on sports going forward. But at the same time, DPH has provided alternatives and options for them to think about, understanding the overall health risk for all the various sports that will be taking place in the fall.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Governor.
The Hartford Current.
Hey, everyone. This is Emily Brindley from The Current. I had a couple questions about the COVID-19 alert that was issued for Danbury. The first is, are there any specific metrics that are used when you're deciding whether or not to issue an alert, or are there metrics that you might use in the future when you're evaluating whether to issue alerts for other towns?
Over to you.
Yeah, no, at the end of the day, it's a judgment call, Emily, and it was based on discussions both with our public health department here at the state, as well as with the mayor and the local health department in Danbury. And it's evaluating a wide variety of factors. Certainly, it's the metrics and the case counts and the trend lines, but it's other factors as well. And so working together with our partners in Danbury at the municipal level, that was the judgment of the Department of Public Health on Friday, that we were seeing enough to know that we wanted to get the word out more aggressively about what we were seeing and the actions that we wanted to see the community take to make sure that we nipped it in the bud.
Let's see if anything of note came out today. Tony Wong is joining us at 5:41. Tony, good to hear from you again. What went on today with this PURA hearing?
Well, it was an opportunity to simply address the rate increase request by Eversource and UI that was originally approved many months ago. And in fact, many of your listeners will have sticker shocked with their bills recently that skyrocketed. That was a result of the rate increase that was granted. What this docket hearing today was truly about reconsidering that rate increase. In fact, PURA, under the new chairman, Marissa Gillette, has actually frozen that rate increase to say, let's reevaluate, have you present to us what justify these rate increases. And what also snuck into the meeting was the built-up frustration of many people talking about their inept storm responses. Mm-hmm. But this meeting today was purely about the rate increase request that is being reconsidered. And I hope that they will reconsider and reject that rate increase, because the sticker shock that I heard from so many constituents is the fact, how could this be that the escalating price to pay for utilities when they're not even performing up to par?
You know, Tony, you were featured on a television report that I saw from one of the state's TV stations. But something that was brought out in that report, which to me just makes me shake my head, is now, for at least some people, Tony, these transmission fees or these other fees that are not the actual cost of the energy used by thousands of Connecticut consumers, these ancillary fees are, in some cases, the report said, twice what the actual energy usage is. And I saw people in that report saying, wait a minute. Here's the amount I'm using in energy, but why am I paying twice as much with some of these fees that just seem like tack-ons and tack-ons and tack-ons?
Well, it's called delivery costs, and it is a escalating hidden cost that builds up. You literally need a PhD to be able to read the calculus of a utility bill. And there are federal charges, there are other ancillary charges, that gets built into it. Some of it was created by legislation in regards to conservation, et cetera. But the delivery charge was one that we had looked at in the General Assembly many years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, when I remember working as the ranking member in energy and technology. And we looked at it and said, geez, California has a delivery charge cap at around $12. And at that moment in time, ours was double perhaps. And that rate continues to increase. It has nothing to do with the cost of the energy that's being consumed. It's the delivery service charge that gets tacked on. It's similar to the hidden bills and an added cost that we see in banking bills that just continue to creep up. It really was one of the dirty little secrets that utilities gain. It has nothing to do with the energy consumed, and it's talking about delivery, but it's adding insult to injury, Paul, because they haven't delivered the service, and they certainly demonstrated by this recent tropical storm were totally unprepared in delivering goods and services to the public trust.
You know, Tony, it almost sounds like the argument you hear, not the exact same thing, but the first thing I thought of was, well, the gasoline tax has to go up because fewer and fewer people are using gasoline. There's a lot of electric cars out there, and the ones that are using gasoline, well, they're more energy efficient now. So, yeah, we know you're being good consumers by switching to more energy efficient automobiles, but we're still going to stick it to you because those of you who still need gas, well, here it comes. I mean, it's almost the same kind of catch-22.
Well, the catch-22 is ultimately the consumer continues to pay. Now, I've heard and spoken to many constituents. They said they would be willing to pay the going rate if only they were secure, reliable, and responsive. Mm-hmm. The utilities were none of these during this tropical storm, and their history has not demonstrated that. So we continue to pay without alternatives, and the inefficiencies continue, if not worsen. So that's the frustration, Paul, is the fact is, what are we paying for? And I think the governor said in the beginning of the storm is, we paid millions of dollars of ratepayer increases because of, quote, lessons learned from Sandy and Irene. There were no lessons learned. No. The money that was spent, where did it go? And when you combine with the reports that came out where the top five executives of Eversource made over $40 million, and their report after the storm to Wall Street is, we see no significant impact to our earnings, to our shareholders. And then we find out that trustees are being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. Where is that money going if not to the pockets of the executive and not preparing a grid system that is reliable and a customer service system that is responsive rather than the brick wall of silence they've had to endure for consumers? You know, Paul, I mean, this is not just UI and Eversource. It's the Optima, Maltese, Frontiers of the world. I still have constituents in Easton, Paul, nearly 3 weeks after this storm that still do not have internet. That's totally unacceptable.
Tony, hang on. I want to come back to you. I want to ask you about some of these calls for a takeover or a breakup. Hang on. More with Tony Wong, Traffic and Weather Together right here on WICC. Back here, Tony Wong with us, Republican State Senator Fairfield. The folks at PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority, had a public hearing today on a recent rate increase from Eversource. And, of course, some of the anger from what happened in the postscript in the wake of Tropical Storm Isaias is kind of boiling over. No surprise there. Senator Blumenthal, according to this story in the Connecticut Post, calling for a breakup of Eversource. We've had General Assembly members allude to that. Tony, is that even... is that a scare tactic? Might they listen? Is that even possible? I know it was done on Long Island and a few other areas of the country, but is that something that should be looked at or at least threatened? Because as you say, listen, you and I obviously have nothing against for-profit companies to protect shareholders. But if the protection of a shareholder, Tony, or shareholders, is going to come at the expense of a promised level of service, even in a storm, I mean, that's not good either.
Without a doubt. And I will share with you, PURA, as a regulatory agency, has had a reputation in the past of being a good old boy network. And things just kind of went through the process. Rate increase got approved. Utilities continue to get their way because they were the only game in town. But I will compliment the current new chairwoman. Her name is Marissa Gillette. She came a year ago, and she has opened up greater accountability, greater transparency. And this storm really is a wake-up call in the sense it was simply a tropical storm, Paul. We have possible storms coming up the horizon. If they're not prepared for this, when are they going to be prepared when the next one hits? So that being said, I think we have to reevaluate what the market competitiveness is. With the money that you're charging us, you are not prepared. And maybe a little competition may be in order to do better. You know, if you're the only game in town and there's that kind of arrogance that I sense, then you know what? We don't have alternatives. This is not just UI and Optimum and Eversource. It's really understanding the marketplace. So to answer your question, yes, everything has to be on the table. And we pointed out that in Wallingford, Norwich, and Groton, as you shared, there's a town-owned or a publicly owned utility that has been responsive, that is accountable to the community, and their job performance has been good, if not better, than most. Mm-hmm. So everything has to be on the table, and there has to be accountability, and I think this may be a time where we have that conversation. It's not going to happen overnight. And perhaps we can look at the Optimums of the world and say there may be other opportunities instead of territorial grants, that everything has to be on the table, Paul. I really genuinely believe this may be the turning point where we say you've not done the work. You've betrayed the public trust as a public utility, and you now need to be competitive and responsive. If that's the only way, then perhaps that is a way we as a legislative body should evaluate it.
I like what the governor said earlier today, Tony, and we carry the comments right here on WICC where, you know, and I think this is a good thing about Governor Lamont coming from with a basically a business background. He said, listen, in my line of work, he said, which was, you know, utility, cable TV, cabling companies, if you did a good job, you get better contracts, you could up your rates a little bit, but if you screw up and you don't meet needs here, why are you getting rewarded on this? And I was heartened to hear the governor say that.
The performance speaks for itself, and Eversource, even in the hearing, continues to hold the line that they were prepared and that they did a excellent job. I offer to say, what world were they in? Have they been tone deaf to the people that could not get through, that could not get a response, that could not manage their expectations? Power and electrical opportunity and resources are a life and health setting. You know, in a world of COVID, it's critical that those at risk and vulnerable have power to be able to manage their resources. And I will tell you, internet is not far behind with the COVID environment, with so many people working from home and such a connectedness to the outside world. I am befuddled and beyond frustrated that 3 weeks people still don't have internet.
Yeah, that's, you know, Tony. I'm sure there are war zones in this world where the great military of the U.S., and I'm not saying this to be flip here, I'll bet you that within certain days, they would even have a temporary kind of thing set up with internet hotspots and mobile units there to help people. Tony, we got to run. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you, Paul. Always appreciate the opportunity.
Appreciate it. Yeah, think about that, folks. 3 weeks? Now, I know what they're trying to do. They have line issues. They have pole issues, tree issues. But I would say, as just a common person, I would say, well, wait a minute. What about bringing in, I know they're like, they have like these mobile hotspots. Can you bring, well, that's going to cost money. Yeah, but can you bring some of those in and put those in areas where at least people would have, you know, basic service? Maybe it's not the high-speed stuff they have. Well, you guess what? You can't watch HD movies for a few weeks.